This is Terra Informa, your source for environmental news. You're tuned in to Terra Informa, and I'm your host, Steve Anderson. Today, Miles Curry looks into the enormous pieces of equipment that are making their way from manufacturing plants in Asia to the Alberta tar sands. He talks to residents of the American Northwest and learns why they're none too pleased that the equipment will be traveling their roads on its way north. And later in the show, Rebecca Rooney talks to a researcher who's looking into ways of reducing our dependence on pesticides. He's hoping to use a naturally occurring fungus to combat insect pests. But as always, we start things off with a wrap-up of the news headlines from across the country. Here's Dave Karchin and Mike McNichol.
This to Alberta, where an army of 600 workers has been deployed in the latest effort to prevent the spread of the notorious tree-killing mountain pine beetle. The teams are concentrating on an area in the northwest of the province, between Hinton, Grand Prairie and Slave Lake, in an effort to prevent the beetle's spread further east. The Alberta government, which is spending $15 million on the effort, aims to cut and burn trees already infested in an effort to kill larvae. In their sights are an estimated 170,000 trees that are currently infested, in the hopes that 6 million hectares of Alberta forests, potentially at risk, can be spared from the beetle's ravages. Due to the rapid breeding and spreading of the mountain pine beetle, each infested tree contains enough larvae to infest a further 10 trees in the next season. The mountain pine beetle is a native to the forests of Western North America. However, in recent years, its numbers have increased dramatically. Milder winters allow the beetles to breed more successfully, and there are fears that climate change is contributing to the increased numbers. The beetles, which kill valuable timber trees, have already affected over 160,000 square kilometres of BC forest. Here's Dr. Alan Carroll of the Canadian Forest Service.
Mountain pine beetle is a native insect that belongs to a group of forest insects known as bark beetles. And basically, bark beetles feed in the succulent tissue beneath the bark, between the bark and the sapwood of trees. And it's usually the female that initiates attacks. And so if she finds a tree that she potentially might like to colonize, she'll land on the bark of that tree. The males arrive to mate with the females, and they begin boring through the bark along with females helping her. And together, these activities lead to a mass attack.
To British Columbia now. Vancouverites will be banned from throwing kitchen scraps in the trash at the end of next year. In an effort to reduce the quantity of garbage heading to the city's landfills, organic waste will be diverted to composting facilities by way of separate green bins for each household. Accompanying this move, most Metro Vancouver cities plan to cut garbage collection to once every 2 weeks, with organic waste collection every week. Metro Vancouver municipalities have signed on to a plan to recycle 70% of the region's waste by 2015. Currently, 55% of the region's waste is recycled. To achieve this, the 256,000 tons of organic kitchen scraps the city produces every year will need to be composted. Composting will be handled by industrial-scale private composting facilities contracted by the metro region. Heavier fines are proposed to accompany the changes to ensure the residents comply with the new directive.
In Toronto, a team of scientists has published compelling evidence for a link between man-made global warming and an increase in heavy rainfall. The team, led by Environment Canada scientist Francis Zwiers, gathered rainfall statistics over the past 50 years and compared them to computer climate models both with and without the effect of humans' greenhouse gas emissions. They found that recent increases in dramatic deluges cannot be explained by natural fluctuations alone. Their data also showed that the probability of heavy downpours grew by 7% in the second half of the 20th century.
At precipitation observations for the second half of the 20th century, we see in those observations that extreme precipitation intensifies over that time. Climate models reproduce that intensification, and they do so in such a way that enables us to deduce that the observed change in intense precipitation is at least in part due to human influence on the climate system.
A second study from the UK, also published this week, corroborates the Canadian scientists' findings. The Oxford University team calculated the probability of flooding rainfall with and without human greenhouse impacts. They found that the chance of large floods, such as the devastating UK floods in 2000, roughly doubled under the human influence model. Both studies were published in the prestigious journal Nature. The past 3 months has seen very severe flooding around the world, particularly in Australia, Sri Lanka, and Brazil. This flooding is linked to the intensity of La Nina. However, a more intense La Nina is one of the predictions of climate change. In addition to this, warmer air can hold more water vapour, leading to increased precipitation and rainfall intensity. For every extra degree Celsius in warmth, the quantity of water vapour held by the air can increase by 7%.
In Quebec, the provincial government has signed a draft accord on investment and development of the mining industry with the government of India. The accord allows for technology exchange, research and development, and encourages the joint seeking of investment capital. Controversially, however, the accord covers the mining of asbestos. Quebec has faced international criticism for its plans to boost production at Canada's last asbestos mine, the largest asbestos mine in the world, which is located near the town of Asbestos. The fibers from the asbestos ore, known as chrysotile, are blamed for millions of deaths worldwide due to its powerful carcinogenic effect. While most developed countries have strong regulations outlawing or controlling the use of asbestos, poorer countries often do not. Critics have accused Quebec of exporting a product unacceptable to Canadians for the sake of rejuvenating an old mine and the jobs it brings. A group of investors has asked the Quebec government for a guaranteed loan of $57 million to expand the mine and boost production for export.
And finally to Nova Scotia, where the controversial seal hunt began last week. Animal rights activists have vowed to document and photograph the hunt in detail and use the photos in their campaign in Europe against Canada's seal products. A group of European countries has already slapped a ban on such products from Canada, prompting the Federal Fisheries Minister, Gail Shea, to announce that Ottawa will be seeking intervention against the ban from the World Trade Organization. The total number of seals that may be hunted this year is 60,000 across Atlantic Canada, a 10,000 increase over last year. The hunt began on Thursday on Hay Island off eastern Cape Breton, where 1,900 grey seals are permitted for taking. Critics insist that the Hay Island hunt is damaging the Cape Breton tourist industry. The hunt comes just 2 months after the Federal Fisheries Minister signed an agreement in Beijing allowing importation of all Canadian seal products, including edible meat and oil, to a potentially large market of Chinese consumers. And that's this week's wrap of environmental news. Back to you, Steve.
Thanks, guys. We keep an eye on the news headlines throughout the week, so if you'd like more frequent updates, just stop by our Facebook page. We post stories on breaking environmental news all throughout the week. Next up, Miles Curry is here to bring us another edition of Local Campaigns. But this one comes from a little further afield than usual. Today, Miles talks to an organizer in the American Northwest who's mobilizing communities against a not-so-well-known extension of the tar sands, the so-called tar sands megalodes. For more on what the megalodes are and community efforts to oppose them, here's Miles with this week's edition of Local Campaigns.
This week on Local Campaigns, we are following the tentacles of the tar sands across the continent to the American Northwest, where the oil companies ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil are in the midst of transporting massive tar sands infrastructure, prefabricated in South Korea, where they can save some dollars on labor, through the American Northwest, up to southern Alberta, then all the way across the province to the tar sands in Fort McMurray. The term mega is barely able to describe the actual size of these loads. Each truck will be over 60,000 pounds, over 210 feet long, almost 24 feet wide, and 30 feet high. This operation equates to almost an entire tar sands processing facility being split up into the largest possible pieces being shipped across the world on boats and trucks. Nothing of this scale has ever been attempted before. To get a better grasp on this massive tar sands operation, I contacted Susie Rosette of Northern Rockies Rising Tide for more details. Can you describe for me the route that these megalodes will be taking and what the environmental risks are along the way?
Well, first off, they're coming in from the Port of Vancouver in Washington, and they're on barges up the Columbia and Snake River into the Port of Lewiston here in Idaho. And they'll be driving over a scenic byway, Highway 12, in through a wild and scenic river corridor up Lolo Pass, which is kind of a scary pass, especially here in the wintertime, and over that into Lolo, Montana. And then they're taking Highway 93 up through Missoula, getting on the highway for a minute, and then going up Highway 200 and some other very scenic highways up through northern Montana. I guess the main thing with the impacts on this particular area is this road is very, very dangerous. There's actually an annual yearly percentage of vehicles that fall off into the river, so it's not an abnormal thing for accidents. Last summer, a diesel tanker truck actually hit a cliff face and spilled 72,000 gallons of diesel fuel into a drainage ditch that drains directly into the Locksaw River. I guess the main worry for this particular area is having them do some damage to the recreation aspects of the area. A lot of the local folks are more worried about that, having something so dangerous go through our area headed to such a horrible atrocity on nature is, you know, we're really not happy with them wanting to stomp all over our ground and then go stomp on somebody else's ground.
Have there been any consultations with the communities that might be affected by this operation?
There has not been. Actually, here in Idaho, they really didn't talk with the community until they already had the plan down and people started talking out against it and really trying to push for more community involvement in the actual project. In Montana, you know, we definitely, it's kind of a very similar aspect, although we have a lot of environmentalists in Montana that are really against people doing anything going to the tar sands. After watching H2 Oil and seeing all the devastation going on up there and seeing how it's affecting all of the First Nations communities, it's atrocious to know that, you know, they're wanting to bring more mining equipment and open up a new mine. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to work hard and stopping them. And apparently so far we've been pretty effective. We've cost them millions of dollars. The big oil companies were thinking that this would be a good idea. And then now that they've seen all of this opposition to their planned route, they're trying to find alternative routes.
How has that opposition shown itself? What sort of have been some of the actions of the community?
There's been a big media strategy. There's been a lot of editorials in the local newspapers. Last summer, we had a big rally at the Montana DOT in Missoula, and basically we're saying that the head of the Department of Transportation in Montana is in bed with Exxon, because when they had originally talked about this plan, the director had said that it would have significant bad impacts on Montana. And then not even a year later, he said, oh, no, this is, you know, it's going to be a good project for Montana. So we think that there's something else going on there with the DOT.
Those of us in Alberta and Canada doing a lot of work on the tar sands, of late we've become very conscious of how the tar sands giga project is becoming entrenched in communities across the globe, really. Do you see any way in which once this route has been done once, is it leaving open for a lot more possibilities?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of a big thing for us is, you know, they say that this is a one-time deal, but as we can see from example in Texas, you know, there was a big oil company that wanted to put a route in for a different type of mine. It's somewhere in Texas. And they said, oh, it's just going to be these 207 trucks. And they allowed them to go through, and then within 3 years, there was over 1,000 trucks that had moved through there. So we see this not as a one-time project. We see this as a long-term industrial high and wide corridor, which nobody in the area really wants. You know, this whole area is very wild, very scenic, and we want to see it stay that way.
So as of right now, what is the current state of the operation?
There's two different oil companies right now that are working on projects. The first one is ConocoPhillips. The ConocoPhillips loads, there are four loads of a two-piece coke drum. So they've cut two coke drums in half and have put them on four trucks. And so that's the first project that's already underway. The second truck left last night. We actually got some video footage of it moving last night through Lewiston over the Arrow Bridge, which, you know, they had a lot of trouble getting over that because these things weigh so much that the structural integrity of the bridges and stuff is really in question. Some of the ConocoPhillips trucks weigh in excess of 600,000 pounds, so they actually have to break down part of the truck to be able to get it over that one bridge. And there are several bridges that they have to cross over along Highway 12 once you get down into the Lockshaw Corridor. ExxonMobil has proposed 207 trucks. They started shipping them up the Columbia and Snake River last summer, and they shipped up 34 pieces of equipment up the river into Lewiston. The main reason they wanted to take this way is because, one, it saves them tons and tons of money, and it also is the shortest route for them.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting for us in Alberta and Canada because, you know, the tar sands were built up in a lot of ways obscured from us. And so now we're getting to see a tar sands operation brought through the continent piece by piece. And it's really making a lot of people say, like, I can't believe that this stuff exists. And it's really showing the scale. So I really appreciate the work you're doing on this issue, and I appreciate you taking the time to do this interview. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Hopefully we'll have something really big here in the media in the next week or so, depending on when these trucks roll through Missoula. You know, we're grassroots folks that are going to stand up for what we believe in and not let big oil stomp all over us.
In order to get a better idea of how these megaloads fit into the larger tar sands gigaproject, I spoke with Mike Hudima of Greenpeace's Stop the Tar Sands campaign. So can you tell us what tar sands projects these megaloads are headed to?
Well, the main shipment is for Exxon, or Imperial's Pearl River project, and that's where the majority of these loads are going to. But there's also a smaller load by ConocoPhillips that will be going to an upgrading station in Montana as well. And so in total, we're looking at about 300 very large loads, if not more, coming up Alberta Highway.
What functions are these loads going to serve in the massive tar sands gigaproject, and what environmental impacts are going to be associated with them once they're in operation?
Well, these loads are really to construct the majority of Imperial's Curl River project, and so all of the infrastructure that's needed will be loaded onto our highways and basically driven up to their project just north of Fort McMurray. And once there, of course, the tar sands industry as a whole is very devastating. It's devastating to water, it's devastating to the land, and it's also devastating to communities. And Imperial's Curl River project is just going to add to that. It's tremendously greenhouse gas intensive. It's 3 to 5 times the greenhouse gas intensive as conventional barrel of oil. It's very water intensive, requiring 2 to 5 barrels of fresh water for every 1 barrel of oil produced. Curl's River's project will also produce or create a gigantic new toxic tailing lake, of course, which has been a very well-told story here in Alberta about what some of the damaging implications of existing tailing lakes are. And then it will further impact the land, the ecosystem, and surrounding communities. And of course, most of that is traditional territory, which will be further impacted by this development.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Hey, no worries. Anytime.
That's been another edition of Local Campaigns. For more info on these megaloads, including videos and pictures which can better illustrate the actual size and scale of these loads than I can on radio, check out our website, terrainforma.ca.
Thanks, Miles. I'm Steve Anderson, and you're tuned in to Terra Informa, your source for environmental news. Don't forget, if you miss an episode of the show, you can always grab a copy of our podcast from terrainforma.ca. You might think an insect is a pretty strange thing for a fungus to grow on. I would certainly agree. Insects and spiders, which biologists collectively call arthropods, are actually the preferred hosts for the parasitic fungus Bovaria bassiana. Bit of a mouthful, but that's not just a peculiar bit of trivia. Sunil Rajput, a former graduate student at the University of Alberta, has been researching the fungus's potential as an alternative to chemical insecticides for use in greenhouses. Terranforma correspondent Rebecca Rooney caught up with him to ask him about his research findings, and she filed this report.
So I'm here today with Sunil Rajput, who is it alumni or alumnus?
Alumni.
I think alumni at the University of Alberta. And what department did you graduate from? Biological sciences?
Biological sciences, yes.
And your research was in reducing pesticide use by implementing biocontrol measures within greenhouses.
Correct.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. With the concerns centered around chemical or synthetic insecticides being insecticide resistant and the harmful effects on humans and the environment, my research was aimed at looking at alternatives, safer alternatives, that can be used to target these insect pests and have a lesser effect on the environment and, of course, humans.
So what sorts of less dangerous means of targeting these pests were you working with?
I was looking at microbials specifically, and there's different types of microbials. So there's bacteria that can be used, there's viruses that are used, protozoans, nematodes, and fungi. And I focused on fungi because the insect pest that I was looking at is western flower thrips, and western flower thrips are plant fluid sucking insects. And so fungi have an advantage because they can be topically applied, whereas other microbials such as viruses, bacteria, in order for them to be effective, they need to be ingested. So we chose fungi because it can be topically applied, which is the most common mode of delivery, and it's effective for plant-feeding insect pests.
Like the thrip.
Like thrip. Other examples of insects that feed on plants are aphids, whiteflies, and these are all greenhouse pests.
So what does the fungus do to the insects?
So what the fungus does to the thrips is basically you spray this as a fungal spores. These are the reproductive propagules, and they basically contact the host surface, and they penetrate into the host body and produce toxins and start consuming the host from the inside and then kill the insect and then reemerges from the dead host to disseminate to another host insect.
So it's self-propagating within the greenhouse system.
Right. And it's selective because the fungi that's being used, not only is it commonly found in the soil and widely distributed worldwide, but it targets only insects.
How does this method relate in terms of efficacy to more traditional pesticides, like chemical pesticides?
Well, when you're comparing a static chemical to a dynamic microbial agent, it's hard to take efficacy one-on-one. So let me explain. When you use a chemical insecticide, a synthetic, when you use this product, it may be more effective at killing the insect. However, you have the build-up towards resistance. You have insecticide residue, depending on how much is applied and at what interval, and then what the active ingredient is in terms of its persistence or chemistry. When you have a biological agent, it may be effective in terms of it does kill the insect, but it may take maybe another day to kill the insect. So it may take some more time, but it is effective at killing the insect over a longer period of time. And that ranges for different biological agents. Now, the advantage is that it's highly selective towards insects. It's self-limiting in the sense that in some cases, if there's no host available, then some biological agents will stay at a baseline level.
And can the insects become resistant to the fungus?
Well, in our case, the fungus wants to overtake the insect, and the insect wants to protect itself from the invading fungus. So there's an arms race there. So the chances of a resistance are less than a static chemical that doesn't change. If the insect changes, the fungus will also change.
So they'll adapt to one another.
Right, right. I think in terms of addressing the question of efficacy, I try to suggest a more broader perspective.
So how well adopted are these practices within commercial greenhouses?
Over the years, though, when I started back in 2001, there was slow adaptation into the greenhouses. However, as the growers become more informed of biological agents and how they work and the advantages, the overall advantages, both long-term and short-term, there's an increasing adaptation towards biologicals. In fact, British Columbia, which so of Canada, British Columbia is ranked second in terms of the provinces of having the largest greenhouse space, I think. If I remember correctly, they're about 30 million square feet of greenhouse space.
Wow.
And they're predominantly biological-based now. That doesn't mean to say that they don't use any chemicals. There are some greenhouses that use a limited amount of chemicals, but they're trying to move away from it. And so this is part of what's called an integrated pest management strategy.
So you're saying BC was number two in terms of space, greenhouse space. Do you know which province ranks number one?
Number one is Ontario. Ontario has about 60-plus million square feet.
I think it's
between 60 and 70 million square feet as of 2003, 2004. I would imagine that it would be higher now.
So, and the sorts of things that are being grown in these greenhouses in BC and Ontario, is that primarily food or is it flowers?
They can be generally classified to vegetables and ornamentals. We grow a lot of vegetables like greenhouse cucumber, greenhouse tomatoes, peppers. These are three big crops in terms of the vegetable side.
Mm-hmm.
The ornamentals, we're looking at Gerbera daisies and poinsettias. These are two very large crops.
And do the thrips that you were studying, do they feed on all of these different species, vegetables and ornamentals?
Yes. Yes. Thrips are a major worldwide pest in both vegetable and ornamental production systems.
So what does a thrip infestation do to a plant?
I'll just give you a couple of examples. So we imagine our cucumber fruit to be straight, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So there's cucumbers that are not put into the market space, the ones that are curled. Have you ever seen curled cucumbers?
No, I don't think I have.
Because they're not marketable. Consumers don't favor curled cucumbers. And that's a result of thrips feeding.
Oh.
On the poinsettia side, consumers demand unblemished leaves. And so what you see with thrips feeding with a light infestation is you see silvering. Basically, it looks like blemishes on a leaf. So when consumers go to any grocery store, they're looking for perfect fruit, perfect vegetables that are blemish-free. And thrips cause damage both directly and indirectly. And what I mean by that is directly by feeding damage and reproductive damage. So when they lay their eggs into the fruit, that leaves a blemish. And when they feed, that also leaves a blemish. And indirectly, they cause damage by transmitting plant viruses.
So they sort of serve as a vector for plant viruses, transferring
yes.
them from plant to plant within the greenhouse.
Yes. So then when growers see thrip infestations, they want to control it as quickly as possible.
Right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, no problem. It's absolutely my pleasure. I love to share this work.
Well, that's it for this week. Catch us again next week for an interview with the mayor of Yellowknife, Gordon Van Tegum. He's going to tell us about his city's ambitious plans to turn an old mine into a source of clean, green geothermal power. I've been your host, Steve Anderson. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR Radio in Edmonton, and you can contact us by emailing terra@cjsr.com. Thanks for listening.
CFRU 93.3 FM is proud to present Just West of Something Big, a compilation of new and unreleased songs by 19 of Guelph's greatest bands, including Gregory Pepper.
I live in a house on wheels and it's slowly going faster.
Water Street Project. And Jenny Omnicord. To get your copy of the compilation, email CFRUCOMP@gmail.com or visit us on the second floor of the University Center. Support local music. Support CFRU, your source for the best independent music for 28 years and counting.
Organic just being cool.